If I can welcome you back. We hope you had a good conversation. We've already got one question up here, so don't forget to keep sending questions forward. I am very privileged today to introduce our speaker, who, of course, we all know works for one of the world's most famous organizations, frankly, of any type. The New York Times has compiled, I am stunned to read, 106 Pulitzer Prizes during its existence. It has, of course, provided writers who have shaped many of us in our lives and our understanding, everything from David Halberstam, who helped many of us understand the Vietnam War, Tom Friedman, who in fact convinced many of us that the world is flat, as well as those who, with great style, explained much of the world and what goes on, like William Safire and Russell Baker and Scotty Reston, and of course our guest here today, who has been a writer and an influential one for a number of years. He's been at the Times since 1999. He's specialized in economic news since 2000. He has a column on Wednesdays, that is called Economic Scene. I won't tell you about all the awards he's won, except the Pulitzer Prize. There are others. And they are not a surprise for an individual who is clearly as thoughtful, precise, and incisive. Some might suggest that may reflect his Yale education in applied mathematics. I've found that mathematicians are fond of parsimony often. I liked very much learning that he, too, like many of us, had an interesting first job in his journalism career, working at Business Week and bringing out the Business School Ranking Report, which you should know has grown into being one of the most influential of such reports. And I'm sure that he has some great stories from that experience, if for no other reason than he used to be able to know every area code there was, because you get to call all of us as part of that job and say, where is the survey? Or please get it to us. He's also, of course, a person of the Times. He has a Twitter account and which claims 15,000 followers. But we invited him here because of his incisive thoughts on economics. And this is an audience we know which is interested in economics, but also incisiveness. So let us welcome David Leonhardt to the podium.
Thank you for that very nice introduction. Thank you all for having me. It is wonderful to be back in Indiana. I've enjoyed seeing how much at the center of the sports world Indiana has been lately, because it's how I first experienced the state. I used to take road trips with a dear friend of mine starting in college and then continuing for about 10 years until we got married and started having kids when it was a little bit harder to go to a Fort Wayne Wizards game for no reason other than we wanted to. But I first remember driving around the state and being totally confused by what time it was, which I believe your governor has fixed. So thank you very much for having me. I'd like to start today by describing a natural experiment that has happened in this country over the last 30 years. And it's a natural experiment that involves two different groups of people, one of which has become much more educated over the last generation, and one of which did not become much more educated. And because of this natural experiment, we can then follow these two groups. We can follow the group that became more educated and follow the group that didn't become so much more educated, and we can see what is the real value, what is the economic value of education, how important is education in economic growth, as some people often talk about. And before I go into the details, let me just say a quick word about natural experiments. So laboratory sciences like biology and physics, they don't have to rely on natural experiments because they can do actual experiments, right? They can go into the lab and make all the conditions perfect and see how changing something affects the outcome. And you do it again and again and again in a perfect setting, and you get comfortable about cause and effect. Social sciences, like economics, don't have that benefit. We can't take two kids and put one in a room for 18 years and educate one really well and then study the differences between the two. We have to look for natural experiments. We have to look for ways this happens on its own in society. But there's also a problem with these natural experiments, which is the old correlation-causation problem. Just because something is happening, it doesn't mean we know what is causing that difference. If you have two towns, and the teenagers in one town are earning much more than the teenagers in another town, you can't just say, well, the teenagers in the first town are more educated, that's why they're earning more, because there are all kinds of differences between the towns. The parents in one town have different jobs. The parents in one town may read to their kids more. The parents in one town may have different preferences. It may have nothing to do with what actually happened during the school year for these kids. And so economists and other social scientists spend an enormous amount of time trying to minimize this correlation-causation problem. Someone once said to me, exaggerating only slightly, nearly all of labor economics is about trying to figure out the value of education using things like natural experiments. What's so beautiful about the natural experiment I'm about to describe is that no one can doubt that our two groups, the one that became much more educated and the one that didn't, are two groups that were determined randomly. In fact, the random difference between the two groups is the basis of the human species. The name for the first group, the one that became much more educated over the last 30 years, is women. The name for the second group, the group that has not become more educated at all over the last 30 years, is men. Let me give you some numbers. In 1979, 29% of 30-year-old men had a four-year college degree. That's 1979. By 2009, only 30% of 30-year-old men did. So men as a group have made almost no progress in college attainment over the last 30 years. To put it another way, find a given 30-year-old, he is probably no more educated than his father was. Women are a totally different story. In 1979, only 20% of 30-year-old women had a four-year degree. So women trailed men 29 to 20. By 2009, 35% of 30-year-old women had a four-year degree. They now lead men 35 to 30. As anyone who's spent any time on a college campus, as I know some of the folks I sat with at lunch, and I know many of you have, are well aware, women have passed men by when it comes to education. They graduate high school at a higher rate, they enroll in college at a higher rate, they graduate from college at a higher rate, they enroll in graduate school at a higher rate, and they graduate from graduate school at a higher rate. So now we have our natural experiment. So let's look at what the outcomes are. For men, pay, just like educational attainment, has barely budged. The inflation-adjusted weekly pay of men has risen just 1% since 1979. It hasn't changed. The inflation-adjusted weekly pay of women has risen more than 25%. Now, I know correlation is not causation. I know that education is not the only reason that women's pay has risen so much more rapidly than men's. We can name other reasons. The worst forms of sexism have disappeared. Today's female college graduates are much less likely than their mothers by choice to choose low-paying professions. Many of those low-paying professions have enormous societal value, but they are low-paying. Women are much less likely to go into teaching than they used to be. The decline of manufacturing and unionization, meanwhile, has disproportionately hit men. So there are definitely other reasons. But education, both common sense and all kinds of rigorous economic research tells us, is the main reason that women have made up so much ground on men and have had such a better last 30 years economically than men. And one way we can see this is to look what's happened to the pay of college graduates within each group. It's up significantly. It's even up for men who are college graduates, despite the overall struggles of men. It's up 20% for men and 30% for women, again, adjusting for inflation. So again, it's up more for women, which is about some of those other factors I talked about. But still, the inflation-adjusted pay for male college graduates is up 20%. Meanwhile, the pay of everyone who doesn't have a college degree has stagnated. It's risen barely at all. It may even have fallen. So think about that. We often talk about the middle class squeeze. We often talk about the great wage stagnation of the last generation. And it's true, wages have been stagnant for nearly everyone over the last decade. But if you look over the longer term, wages haven't been stagnant for college graduates. The gap in pay between college graduates and everyone else is at an all-time high. Today's college graduates are indeed making more than their predecessors, just as people say is supposed to happen over time. The great fear that life still isn't getting better in this country doesn't apply to college graduates. Life still is getting better for college graduates in this country. I'm guessing that I probably don't have to twist the arms of most people in this room to persuade you that education matters a lot, maybe even more than anything else. And for that matter, there are a lot of people outside of this room who are probably easy to persuade of that. There are certainly a lot of people who say that they believe that, right? I'm going to be the education mayor or the education governor or the education president. There's barely anyone who runs for office without saying that education will be a huge part of their agenda once in office. But beneath all of this happy talk about education, I actually think there's a pretty strong undercurrent of skepticism today toward education in American society. And I probably don't have to persuade you of that either. You can see it a lot to engage in a little bit of self-criticism from the media. Throughout this recession and the disappointing recovery, the media has been filled with stories of college graduates who can't get jobs. It's often packaged as this boldly counterintuitive story. You think college is worth it, but look at these 24-year-old kids who can't get jobs. And the bottom line of all those stories is maybe, just maybe, education is overrated. You can also see the skepticism of education from the political left. There are think tanks like the Economic Policy Institute, which is a labor-backed think tank in Washington, does a lot of interesting, good work. It also tends to argue that education is overrated and that education won't protect workers from offshoring and from China and from profit-hungry corporations. And you can see a different version of this skepticism from the political right. Conservatives like Charles Murray will argue that a lot of kids are ill-served by college, basically because they would say that they're not smart enough for college. And more important than any of this intellectual skepticism in the media or in politics, I think you see it in pop culture. I don't think most kids trying to decide whether to go to college are reading a lot of Charles Murray. But pop culture really affects kids, and it matters. For kids in my generation, it was the 1989 song Closer to Fine by the Indigo Girls. It summed up the usefulness of college thusly: I spent 4 years prostrate to the higher mind, got my paper, and I was free, as if those 4 years in that paper had no actual significance. More recently, and more importantly, it was Kanye West. His debut album was called College Dropout. And if you permit me a little editing, I will spare you a verbatim reading of the lyrics and offer you an edited version instead. The title track, College Dropout, offers his take on the career ladder for college graduates at the Gap. Entry-level position, followed by kissing up to the boss, followed by a promotion to be the secretary's secretary. The college dropout of the title, on the other hand, is, of course, the mega-successful Mr. West. Given all this skepticism, I think it's important to look with very clear eyes at the evidence about what kind of difference education makes for most people who gets it, who get it. And what does that evidence say? It says, in the simplest terms, that education seems to be the single best bet that a society or an individual can make. It historically has been the lifeblood of economic growth. Why? Because education helps people figure out how to do things that they're already doing better. It helps people figure out how to make things or accomplish tasks better or more quickly than they were doing before, which in turn lets them do more and do things better. And that in turn lets a society leverage every other investment that it makes in manufacturing, in alternative energy, in medical research, and to do all those things better, to make more, to give us a more affluent lifestyle, to give us more leisure, to let us live longer, you name it. I'll get into some of the evidence, the details of that evidence in a minute. But I first want to take just a quick brief detour to talk about what are some of the other magic bullets And I'm not suggesting education's a magic bullet, but what are some of the other magic bullets that are often offered for economic growth? That is, if we wanted to focus on one thing to really make the economy grow, what would it be? The most obvious maybe is tax cuts, right? Over the last 30 years, that has been perhaps the most popular strategy for trying to lift economic growth. Cut taxes, the theory goes, and economic growth will take off. And the notion that lower taxes should lead to faster economic growth as a theory is fairly unassailable. If what you're doing is cutting taxes and allowing everyone to keep just a little more of each dollar that they earn, people should work more, they should invest more, and more work and more investment should lead to some of that additional prosperity. The real uncertainty is about the magnitude of that effect. Given all of the forces out there in the economy, how much does it affect behavior and affect economic growth to take the top marginal tax rate from 39 to 35, or to take it from 35 to 39, or to take a different tax rate from 25 to 28, or 28 to 25? And on that question, the magnitude of the effect of tax cuts, we have 60 years of evidence to draw upon. And it turns out that tax rates may not have nearly the size of the impact that it would be nice to believe. I would love to believe, come April 15th, that if you just let me keep more of my money, all of our problems as a society would be easier to solve. I would much prefer that. But it's not exactly what history shows. In the 1950s and 60s, we had top marginal tax rates of near 90%. Those are the two decades with the fastest economic growth since World War II. In 1993, after Bill Clinton raised taxes, Larry Kudlow, who you can still see on CNBC, said, "There is no question that President Clinton's across-the-board tax increases will throw a wet blanket over the recovery." The late 1990s was the only period in which economic growth came close to matching the growth of the 1950s and 60s. And our most recent experience, of course, were the tax cuts of 2001 and 2003. They came with all these great promises of economic growth. Instead, even before the financial crisis began in 2007, the economic growth of last decade was slower than in any decade since World War II. Let me repeat that. Even before the crisis started, the economic growth last decade was slower than in any decade since World War II. So tax cuts certainly do not seem to be a magic potion for economic growth. In the right circumstances, they can help. President Reagan's tax cuts seemed to help growth in the 80s. President Kennedy's seemed to help growth in the 60s. All else equal, we should look for ways to hold down tax reform. Tax rates. Tax reform, in which we lowered rates and got rid of loopholes, probably would have something of a boost to economic growth. But the idea that our growth boils down to whether the top rate is a few percentage points here or a few percentage points there, or the capital gains rate is a few percentage points here or a few percentage points there, just doesn't square with history, much as we might want it to be so as taxpayers. So if it's not taxes, what else might it be? Another theory is a theory that I call the nostalgia theory. And I will confess that by using that name, I'm probably tipping my view of the theory. It's the notion that if we could just go back to the 1950s and 60s, maybe we even just hike tax rates to 90% and not worry about what it does to growth, everything would be fine. We put up trade barriers, we enact an industrial policy that says everything's about manufacturing. We go back to a time when a high school diploma was all you needed in order to guarantee a middle-class lifestyle. The problem with this theory is that it imagines the world doesn't change. It imagines that American corporations are no more mobile than they were in the 1950s and 60s, that they can't go open plants elsewhere. It forgets that a middle-class wage in 1950 was nothing like a middle-class wage today. A typical family makes twice as much today, even after accounting for inflation, as in the 1950s. We don't actually want to bring back the jobs of the 1950s, factory jobs that paid only a few dollars an hour. There is a reason that many of those jobs have moved to poorer countries. They are jobs for a different point in a country's economic life cycle. We should be very glad not to be at that point anymore. This isn't a speech about manufacturing, and manufacturing is absolutely central to the future of the American economy. But I think sometimes its role can be exaggerated. And I'd ask you to think back a couple centuries. Think back to a time when manufacturing wasn't the thing we held on to as if only we could get back to it, but it was this strange, newfangled kind of work. It was dirty, it caused health problems, And a lot of really smart people, including Thomas Jefferson, thought it was a grave mistake to move toward an economy in which anything other than agriculture was at the center of what the economy did. That was the nostalgia theory back then. We can't move beyond agriculture. Obviously, we are vastly richer for having moved beyond agriculture. And there's nothing that says a manufacturing economy is the final stage of economic development any more than an agriculture economy is. What we want is an economy that provides a bounty of good jobs, many of them in manufacturing, many of them in services, and not a few of them still in agriculture as well. And so the question is, how can we build that economy? What does the evidence tell us on this? The rate of economic growth for the American economy is something that is too important to leave to wishful thinking. I think it's entirely possible that we may learn things about manufacturing that it is special in some certain ways. I think it's entirely possible that we may get evidence on tax rates and say, you know, we really got to be careful above this level. But the idea that we decide in advance that low tax rates or manufacturing or anything else is the key to our future because we want it to be so is a deeply dangerous thing. The growth rate of the American economy will dictate the living standards not only of ourselves and of our children and of our grandchildren, but it will also dictate the United States' role in a very scary world. A higher rate of growth leads to a more powerful, more influential United States. If we make those decisions based on wishful thinking, we're taking an enormous risk with the future. And that's what brings us back to education. Education is the economic growth strategy with the single best claim on historical success. My favorite book on this topic is called The Race Between Education and Technology. It's by two economists, Claudia Golden and Larry Katz. And in the book, they argue that the 20th century was the American century, in large part because it was the education century in this country. They sort through all this great data, old censuses in Iowa, much more recent data, both data and rich historical narrative. And they conclude that their fellow economists have exaggerated the importance of technological change when they talk about something like income inequality. Income inequality hasn't grown because technological change is much faster than it used to be. Clearly, there's all kinds of technological change around us, right? We've got these. But technological change isn't new, right? We have the internet, but we also had the PC and the mainframe. And before that, we have the jet engine and the automobile and the telephone. The rate of technological change over the last century, when you smooth out the little peaks and valleys, actually looks to be relatively standard, relatively constant. It's not much faster than it used to be. What has changed is the supply of highly skilled workers who can use that technology, and specifically the change in the amount of that supply. So we used to be educating our population at an incredibly rapid rate. We passed the rest of the world by. We had by far the greatest portion of college graduates among any country in the world. And now those gains have slowed down enormously, in large part because of the trends involving men that I mentioned. And so the rate at which we have become more skilled has slowed down. The rate at which technology has changed has kept going. And that helps explain a significant portion of the inequality we see today. That helps explain why college graduates have continued to do well and people without a four-year degree have really struggled. There aren't enough people out there who know how to use the technology really well. And by technology, I mean that defined in the broadest sense. And so the wages for them have gone up. We have too many people who are relatively low skilled, and the wages for them have not gone up. Golden and Katz use all sorts of regression analyses to make their case. And by education, I want to be clear, I don't just mean four-year college degrees. It can also be two-year college degrees. It can also be certificates of different kinds. I'm not going to walk you through those regression analyses because I don't understand them, and I don't think most people here would. But we don't need them to know that education plays a role that almost no other factor does in economic growth. That's why I like that man-woman story so much. Those of us who don't have PhDs in economics can understand it. And it's hardly the only story out there. One of my favorite ways to look at this involves religion, in part because it makes everyone just a little bit uncomfortable. So anyone want to guess what the single most educated religion in the United States is? It is Hindus. Hindus are also the religion that overwhelmingly live in households making $100,000 a year. I have a chart here, which I can't put up, but I'm happy to tell you where to find it, that plots education and income by religion. And it's like a straight line. The most educated religions are the most prosperous. The least educated religions are the least prosperous. Again, I understand cause and effect is working in funny ways here, both ways. But that is yet another example of how it works. Think about regions. Think about old manufacturing regions that have not become really hard time regions. If you've been to upstate New York, you can see what happens when the factories leave. If you've been to Boston, you don't spend a lot of time thinking about where all the factories went because they've been replaced by high-skilled jobs from an extremely educated population. You see the same sort of thing in Minnesota. Whether it's regions, whether it's religions, whether it's countries, whether it's men and women, you can see the enormous economic effect of education again and again. And to use just the most obvious example, despite all of that skepticism about the value of a college degree, the gap in pay between college graduates and everyone else is at an all-time high. Does all this mean that education guarantees a good life? No, it obviously does not. College graduates have suffered less than any other group in the recession, but they've still suffered. We've gone through the worst financial crisis in 80 years. Of course they've suffered. Everyone has suffered. The solution to our economic problems almost certainly can't revolve only around education. And I think education advocates have a responsibility to say so. Education has an incredibly long lead time. It won't help many 50-year-olds. It won't help workers who've spent their lives training for one kind of economy and then at the age of 40 or 50 or 60 find themselves in a different kind of economy. My own industry is something of an example of that. People need things other than education for a decent life. They need some kind of safety net. They need freedoms to do what they want. They need an education system for their own kids that won't just educate the children of a lot of us, but will educate even people who grow up without many of the advantages that people whose parents were well-educated have. Perhaps most important, I just want to emphasize that education is not a solution for many individuals. It is the solution with the best record of success long-term for a society. As Keynes said, in the long run, we're all dead. And so telling people that education is the best strategy for them is not a replacement for a set of economic policies that helps everyone have a good life. But again, education is the best solution for long-term growth. It's the best solution for lifting living standards for the greatest numbers of people. And so that raises the question of how we can do that. What can we do to maximize the odds that we have rising living standards? What can we do to maximize the odds that the United States remains the world's preeminent power? There are three very short things. I'm not going to go into detail on any of them. One, you need to spend resources. It doesn't come from nowhere. Education isn't free. One of the most worrisome things that happens in a recession is that the cost of health care grows, in part because more people move on to the government health care because they lose their jobs. And states often have a very one-on-one relationship. As health care costs grow, they have less money in their budgets for education, and they cut their education budgets. And we've seen that this time. Cutting budgets is almost certainly not a solution to a population that, remember, over time needs to become more educated. We don't just need to stay in place. We need to keep up with all of that technological change. I think the second of the three things is those resources have to be well used. Right now, there's an enormous amount of wasted money in education. We don't necessarily pay for outcomes. We sometimes simply pay both universities and students to sit in seats and to enroll. West Virginia has recently started an experiment that I love to talk about, in which they have said in order to qualify for their generous statewide scholarship, students must remain on track to graduate in 4 years. You fall off that pace and you lose your scholarship. That has a very powerful effect on whether kids actually graduate and do so in 4 years. And there's been some good research to show how it's lifted the graduation rate in West Virginia. And the final thing, which is connected to number two, is accountability. Too much of our education system simply isn't accountable to taxpayers or to students or to parents. The whole notion of accountability in education engenders an enormous amount of controversy. And there is no one perfect measure, right? Test scores are not a perfect measure by any means. But the one thing, one question I would ask people who talk about how bad test scores are is, okay, if not test scores, then what? You can't simply promise me that you're doing a good job as a school or as a principal and ask me to take your word on it. You need to produce some kind of evidence that you're actually teaching students, that you're actually giving them the tools they need to thrive in this economy. And simply saying that we're working really hard and we're trying to get it done doesn't qualify as evidence that you're getting it done. And so if it's not going to be test scores, it probably needs to be something. All of these things are immensely different. Our education system has huge strengths. It also has big weaknesses. It's highly decentralized. It's all over the country. There are different problems in each region. In some places, it's an enormous problem how long it takes kids to get to school. In other places, it's a huge problem how few kids eat a good breakfast. There are a huge variety of problems, and one thing won't solve them all. I do not want to suggest that improving the education system in this country is something that is simply a matter of let's try to do it and we'll do it. It won't be. It will be hard, but it also can be done. And the reason we should have that confidence is that we've done it before. A century ago, the world's rich countries, the United States and Europe, were trying to decide how much of a commitment they were each willing to make to education. At the time, college wasn't the frontier. High school was the frontier, right? Large numbers of kids went to grade school. Large numbers of kids by a century ago could read. But high school was sort of out there. It almost was for the elites. And there were definitely people who wondered, reasonably enough, did it make sense to send everybody to high school? Or was it a waste to send everybody to high school? Do we really need these high school degrees in order to prosper as a society? Aren't we always going to need manual laborers? Isn't it a waste of their time and our resources to send everybody to high school? The major countries of Europe initially made a decision that was essentially based on this skepticism. They decided that everybody didn't need a high school education. They decided it was okay to keep it as something for the elites. The United States decided, through a series of small decisions and then some larger ones, that everyone should have a high school education. It was okay to, quote, waste a high school education on some people. And that decision is what made the 20th century the education century, and in turn, in large part, made it the American century. Our mass-educated population didn't just create the great white-collar jobs we know about, the PC industry, the film industry, the biotechnology industry. It also created an enormously productive blue-collar economy. Those high school graduates fanned out into companies like Caterpillar and General Motors, and they were able to make things better and smarter than much of the rest of the world could. Today, no one questions that high school should be for the masses. It is assumed. The debate is whether we are wasting education on college graduates. And what I would ask is, where is it that says 13 years of education is exactly what students should have? If before we thought it might be 9 and now we've gone to 13, what's wrong with 15 or 17? Why is it that everyone shouldn't get more education than previous generations did in order to create a more prosperous country than previous generations had? I think the single best point for optimism is to look what people do when it comes to education, rather than what they say. There are a lot of skeptics when people talk about whether education has value. There aren't that many skeptics when they make decisions about their own children. Nearly everyone, including the people I cited earlier as education skeptics, send their own children to college. Some of them, who write articles in the media and for think tanks, send their children to very expensive colleges and take out enormous amounts of debt for an investment that they claim to think is not worth it. And so when we look at what we do as a country rather than what we say, I actually think we have an enormous amount of confidence in education. And I think the long-term record suggests that we are right to do so. Thank you very much for having me today, and I look forward to questions.
Thank you very much. Again, questions, cards are welcome up here. And I will start with a question that is not focused on education. We'll come back to that, but you mentioned it in passing. You happen to work in one of the industries that has experienced enormous challenges over the last few years. And so you were asked, using your crystal ball, what will the newspaper industry look like 10 years from now?
I do not have a crystal ball. Anyone who writes about economics and has tracked economic forecasts over time is well aware of the dangers of forecasting the future. So I guess what I would say is I'm mostly optimistic about the future of media, but it comes with a significant amount of deep concern about certain kinds of media that have played a hugely important role in the history of the country and continue to today. So there is enormous demand for news today. People have, if anything, a greater desire for information and news than they did in the past. And the news business predates the newspaper business, right? It is as old as town criers and other things. And so I'm really optimistic that there will continue to be a thriving, if smaller, mass media in this country that in a few cases has the resources to devote to accountability journalism, investigative journalism, covering wars. We're now spending an enormous amount of money to have people in Afghanistan and Iraq and other places. We spend a huge amount of money on security. We spend a huge amount of money on travel and rent and translators. And I think that one of the great gifts that Steve Jobs did a lot of things that people in legacy media businesses like mine, it makes us uncomfortable. But Steve Jobs also gave us a great gift, which is he began to get people comfortable with the idea of paying for information with just little clicks on your phone or your iPad or your computer, starting with music and now on to other things. We at the New York Times have started charging. The experiment is going, it's not an experiment, the effort is going extremely well. It is true that our long-term display advertising trends are not good, but I think ultimately if you have, if you're putting out a product that people want, you're going to have numbers of them who are willing to pay for it. That's what we're starting to see. And you can imagine a future of the news business in which you don't have quite the same amount of advertising revenue, but you also don't have the costs because you take out some of the costs thanks to technology. My concern is that I think that is a business that probably will mostly have to be national in scale. And so I think the path for local news organizations is much less clear. I don't have any great advice. And I do have concerns, which is local newspapers and television stations and radio stations and weeklies have just played an incredibly important role in holding people accountable. There's even some economic research that suggests when a local newspaper goes out of business, instances of corruption go up. And I don't exactly know how the newspapers get from where they are to the future, but I guess I'm hopeful that in the same way, you put something out that people want, and eventually you'll find enough people willing to pay for it.
Thank you. We've got some very good questions, as always, probing some of the arguments you make. And so let me cluster a couple of these. Two speakers or writers are asking, are we currently facing an education inflation where today's college degree is equivalent to a high school degree? And a corollary, which is, will an extreme increase in the number of college graduates diminish the better quality of life going forward?
Those are good questions. So the first thing is you look at the gap between the pay in college graduates and the pay of everyone else, right? If the value of a degree was going down, that gap should be shrinking. Instead, it has been growing. Right? Unfortunately, in recent years, it's mainly been growing because the pay of college graduates has kind of held steady and the pay of everyone else has gone down. But one of the choices in our economy is not, do you want to live in a world that went through the financial crisis or don't you? Right? If that was a choice, I'd take the second choice. But since that's not one of my choices, you have to live in the economy that we have. A college degree, the returns on it are still greater than they were. So then the question becomes, what if we vastly increase the number of college graduates? Is that likely to bring down their pay? And I think the answer to that is twofold. In a very narrow sense, it is likely to bring down their pay, but that's sort of what we want. When we say we want to bring down inequality, what we want to do is reduce the gap between the people who've been left behind and the people who've gotten ahead. And so what we want is faster relative gains for the people who've been left behind. And if by increasing the supply of educated people and decreasing the supply of less educated people, we essentially bring down inequality by having the relative pay of college, of non-college graduates go up, that would be a really good thing. The more important point, though, is the economy is not, it's not a fixed pie. It's not a zero-sum game, right? If we have more college graduates and more PhDs and more community college graduates, we are going to be a more productive country. We're going to make more, and so the overall size of the pie will grow. So what history suggests is that if we get more educated people, the relative gap between them and everyone else will shrink. And again, I think that's what we want. But the overall size of the pie will grow.
I think a good follow-on to that is a question which says, why is it that the United States seems so resistant to make the economic educational shift to an information-based, technology-based economy? There is still so much wailing and gnashing of teeth over the loss of manufacturing jobs.
Well, so I would say, I mean, for a lot of people, the concern about manufacturing is deeply, deeply rational, right? Manufacturing did provide a really wonderful middle-class lifestyle for mass numbers of people. And we haven't figured out what replaces it yet, right? We haven't yet figured out how to build an economy that has rapidly rising living standards for mass numbers of people. And so the idea that we look back somewhat longingly at manufacturing, to me, makes all kinds of sense. I just want to make sure we don't think that because it worked in the past, by definition, it will work in the future, and it's the only thing that will work in the future. I think making this kind of transition is enormously hard. I mean, if you just look at, physically look at schools, right? Schools look like factories, and there's a reason why they do. They started to educate people to work in factories, right? That's why you have buzzers and why you have desks and rows, and making this transition is not at all easy. In some ways, we're making it better than other countries. I was in China about a year and a half ago, and I'm sure some of you have been as well and have had the same experience I had, which is you talk to people in the Chinese educational system or in businesses in China, and all they want to know is, how do we do what you guys are doing? How do we create an education system and an economy that actually lets people innovate? Right? We don't have a Facebook or an Apple or a Twitter or, for that matter, a GM. And you all do. And so I think we're having trouble with this transition. But it's not clear to me that that it would be possible to make without having trouble with it.
In my experience, the question was framed, how do we create the liberal arts, which I thought by the Chinese asking that very question.
Yeah.
A couple of our questioners are asking hard questions about colleges, including the question of the continuing rise in tuition cost, which is increasing the opportunity cost, obviously, for the individual who goes there, as well as the corollary, which is what about funding models for colleges, given your point about the impact of like healthcare cost on the recession and for those of us in state institutions?
I think the rise in tuition is deeply worrisome. I think it is a combination of a number of factors. First is one we shouldn't worry too much about and often gets overlooked, which is that the cost of nearly all services provided by high-skilled people has gone way up. So it would be one thing if the cost of higher education had gone way up, but healthcare hadn't. Dentistry hadn't. For that matter, entertainment hadn't. But basically, any service provided by people with high skills is much more expensive than it used to be. This gets into some economic ideas that I think are more complicated than we want to go to. But so I think it's okay and probably unavoidable that education costs are going up. But they're going up too fast, clearly. And I think they're going up too fast for some of the same reasons that healthcare costs are going up too fast, which is there isn't enough of a market mechanism within education. There isn't enough accountability. There isn't enough competition in certain ways. And so it is possible for colleges to continue raising their tuition without worrying about competition, without worrying that they're going to be undercut by a cheaper college that can go out and say, hey, you know know what? We don't have that fancy name, but we get better results, and we're going to prove it to you, and we're going to steal market share from that fancy college name. We don't really have that in education, and it would be great if we did. My guess is we're going to get more of it because of how expensive education is getting, and also because of technology, right? It simply is going to be possible to do models of education in new ways, and that should bring some of the productivity gains into education. And I would hope it means we'll have new players, whether that's Khan Academy, that's gotten a lot of attention. You should look it up if you haven't heard of it. It's a guy giving lectures on the internet that are really quite good. Or whether it's existing universities that figure out ways to innovate and thus bring the cost down. So I think costs are a huge problem in education. I still haven't yet seen a good argument that it's economically rational for any student to not go to a state college because of the cost and instead to look for a job as a high school graduate. It's worth remembering there are colleges that don't cost all that much. A lot of state colleges are not nearly as expensive as the sticker prices we see in headlines. Community colleges are even more affordable than that.
A question that, in fact, ties together the point about global competition with the argument you made about the Bush tax cuts resulting in slower domestic economic growth. And this person's saying, but you didn't account for that domestic growth numbers were infected by global competition. Wouldn't have growth been even slower without those tax cuts?
I certainly didn't mean to suggest that the slow growth was the result of the Bush tax cuts. The slow growth was not prevented by the Bush tax cuts. And I think it's entirely possible. I think it's probable that growth would have been a little bit slower without the tax cuts. But that's sort of not good enough, right? Because the tax cuts also left us with a huge deficit that we're going to have to pay for with either future spending cuts or future tax increases. And again, the contrast between the 1993 tax increase greeted with huge predictions of a growth slowdown that don't materialize, and the 2001 and 2003 tax cuts greeted with huge predictions of faster growth that doesn't materialize, should make us deeply skeptical about the size of effects of a cut in marginal tax rates.
Why don't we, as a wrap-up, there's in your point, you were discussing the need for efficiency, and one of the ways this is being operationalized is asking us, in this case, several of us at this table, to graduate students more quickly, to limit the number of credit hours, for example, to a degree. And public institutions would also probably point out, as this person did, that their states are reducing funding for those institutions. What levers do you think that policymakers should be exercising in order to increase the efficiency of institutions, universities, and colleges?
I don't know what levers they should be using. I agree. I think implicit with that question is you need to be a little bit careful what you wish for. If policymakers begin pushing schools to graduate kids, schools may graduate kids without actually teaching them anything and just kind of become diploma mills. I would say I have more faith in most institutions than the logical outcome of that suggests. I do think it's possible to build in accountability measures that matter, and I don't think that graduation rates should be the only accountability measures. I mean, if I were a state legislator, I would be deeply tempted to begin tying state funding to a range of outcomes, and I think Governor Daniels has begun to do some of those things here. You know, so it wouldn't just be graduation rates. You also would want some kind of measure of how much kids actually learned while they were in college, and those tests exist. And so I think the questioner is absolutely right that you need to be careful of perverse incentives when you set up accountability. And one of the ways to do that is to rely on sort of a real mix of different kinds of accountability.
So let's give a round of applause for our speaker.
Thank you all very much.
I think you see why his reputation for analysis and incisiveness, not ducking a hard question, and challenging us as an audience, and I really appreciate bringing that. Obviously, as an educator, I was pleased to hear the analysis, but as a citizen, I'm even more challenged by your comments of the importance of this and the role we have, all of us here who do this, to create economic growth. So thank you very much to that, and thanks to the Lumina Foundation, which helps support this, as well as Butler, who, as I said, is our luncheon sponsor. We appreciate it very much, all of you who sponsored, as well as, of course, our speaker. Today's presentation, thank you, Lloyd, will be available on WFYI Public Radio 90.1 FM Monday, April 2nd at 1 in the afternoon, and is also available for download at WFYI.org. I want to recommend this for those of us who've had to miss an occasional speaker. It was terrific to be able to download and to listen to it. Our next luncheon will be on April 23rd, which will be featuring Hoosier astronaut Dr. David Wolf, who is a graduate of Purdue University's outstanding program, as well as Indiana University's medical school. And we will be very pleased to welcome him here. Have a great afternoon.
Thank you.